I'm Steve Bijou, and this is Down Home Corner. Are you from Canada's East Coast? Proud of your roots? Well, you're like me, you're a down-homer, and we are all connected. On this episode, we connect once again with Campbellton's own Byron Christopher, broadcaster, journalist, and author. Welcome to the show. We're really excited about being back and having Byron back for another webisode of Down Home Corner. Byron is going to walk us through the story of fugitive Richard Lee McNair, who he is, how he escaped from maximum security in Louisiana, where he went during that year on the lam, and his capture in, of all places, Campbellton, New Brunswick. We'll get to that shortly, but I just wanted to remind you that we're working on the show's website, and it should be up and running for our next show. Easy domain name to remember, downhomecorner.com. More on that soon. Please remember to share our show on social media like Facebook, and like our Facebook page if you haven't already. Thank you for your support. It helps to connect more and more down-homers all the time. Coming up, Byron Christopher and the story of Richard Lee McNair. But first, happy 70th birthday to Matt Minglewood.
In a town beneath the border, there's a woman who cries at night. She has been a loner ever since he's known her, but she keeps her loneliness out of sight. Somewhere up the coast near the Bay of Fundy, there's a place called Dorchester Town. In a cell in a block behind the walls of the prison, there's a man. Somehow the years have passed and two more hours he's free at last. He'll walk past that wall. 60 miles down the road, she's driving north with a heavy load. She's not sure at all.
Never end up on the road.
That is the great Matt Minglewood and Dorchester. Kind of fits into this program pretty good, don't you think? Anyway, Matt is celebrating his 70th birthday, so we wish Matt Minglewood a happy 70th. And by the way, the new album, yes, a new album out from Matt Minglewood. It's called Fly Like Desperados. Everybody in the band now from Cape Breton, great album. Make sure you go out there and pick it up, okay? Support East Coast talent and Matt Minglewood, one of the all-time greats. And now to this week's show. There are iconic scenes in many American movies where conversations take place around local events or gossip. In the States, barbershops are the gathering places where local news is often exchanged. In Canada, these places would probably be most represented by Tim Hortons or your local hockey rink. The Campbellton Memorial Civic Arena is where I heard the story, the news of the capture of Richard Lee McNair. It was October 2007, and I was public address announcer for the Restigouche Tigers. I love getting to the games a little early. I had a chance to chat with local hockey types, arena staff, fans, everybody kind of thing. One night, everybody's conversation was the same. Did you hear about the guy on America's Most Wanted they caught in Campbellton? Well, turned out it wasn't a rumor. I guess when you think about it, stranger things have happened in Campbellton. Well, years later, I get the full story from someone who knows it probably better than anyone on this planet, Campbellton journalist, author, and broadcaster, Byron Christopher. Byron was the first person in media to make contact with Richard Lee McNair, and it led to a book called The Man Who Mailed Himself Out of Jail. Welcome back, Byron Christopher. Well, Byron, there's nothing like a down-home story, and a great down-home story is an international story, and that's the story of Richard Lee McNair. Now, he was an escaped convict out of Louisiana, and he ended up in Campbellton, of all places. So let's just talk about him. First of all, he was on America's Most Wanted, and he was captured in Campbellton, and we'll get to that in a minute, but let's first off talk about what he was in jail for.
Yeah, he was in prison, actually, for a homicide. It was a murder of an American man that happened at a grain elevator on the outskirts of a place called Minot, M-I-N-O-T, in North Dakota. Richard Lee McNair was a U.S. Sergeant with the U.S. Air Force, stationed there in Minot. And he was... let's say he needed to be occupied mentally rather than, you know, climb mountains or jump out of airplanes and parachutes and that. McNair went to the dark side to get his rush. And he did break-ins in industrial places around Minot after hours. And the police couldn't catch this guy. He was quite smart. Until one night, McNair was interrupted during a break-in. He ended up shooting two men, killing one of the men. And that's what he was incarcerated for.
So that was the biggest, that was what he was incarcerated for. But the crime that he was probably most convicted of was escaping from prison, no?
Yeah, that's correct. He was known, I guess, in the biz as an escape artist. He's perhaps the best in the world, never mind North America or you know, this continent. But he was absolutely the best in the world, yeah. He escaped from... a county jail. He busted out of there and they put him in a different, a more secure jail. He almost got out of there. They only caught him by fluke. Then they moved him to a state penitentiary and he escaped from there. And once they caught him 9 months later, they put him in a larger federal penitentiary. And no one at that point had escaped from the federal pen in 13 years. McNair did it. He was rather clever in doing it. He shipped himself out of jail in the package. And that is the one I think he's most famous or infamous for. You pick the words there. And he is the guy who escaped from a penitentiary in Pollock, Louisiana, back in 2006. And a year and a half later, he was captured in Campbellton, New Brunswick, by the RCMP. So he is the guy who put Campbellton on the map for about a month.
I was living in Campbellton at the time, and ironically, I was the
PA announcer for the Restigouche Tigers at a hockey game. And you know, I think hockey arenas are kind of the equivalent of barbershops in the U.S. That's where all the news gets exchanged before and after our games, you know. But I remember hearing about this guy, and I thought, okay, interesting. And at first I thought it was a bit of a joke or a hoax, and then I found out, no, it was for real. And it became very interesting, of course, to hear the story, but not at the level that you found out, of course. Now, you turned that into a weekly series in the Campbellton Tribune, and then eventually you wrote a book called The Man Who Mailed Himself Out of Jail. So give us the timeline. He is in prison, and he's escaping. Where does he go? How does he do it?
Well, he's in this penitentiary in Pollock, Louisiana, a fairly new one, which means it's more high-tech. He escapes by putting himself in a pallet of mail bags and by wrapping the mail bags in would be a shrink wrap. And he did this by himself. Try to imagine that, getting into a shrink wrap stack of mail bags without any help. He found a way to do it. And it was simply by using baby powder on the shrink wrap. It loses its ability to cling. And he was able to get in and out that way. And he made a rabbit hole to get in there. And he devised a breathing tube, and he had it all set up with water and everything, because he didn't know how long he would be in that contraption. And he was in the direct sunlight in Louisiana. It was a very hot day. It was 100 degrees in the shade. You can imagine what it was like in the hot, blistering sun. And under shrink wrap, it was like a sauna, worse than a sauna. But he managed to survive, and when he did get out, he bolted to freedom. He made his way down railway tracks in Louisiana and over, and he ended up stealing a vehicle down there and going over to Texas and up through the United States on a bus and crossed into Canada and British Columbia and back into the States again, across the United States back and forth several times, back into Canada in Ontario, and then into Ottawa, where he spent couple of weeks or so. He quite enjoyed Ottawa, he says. Then down into Montreal, across Quebec, into New Brunswick, where he stopped in Campbellton, then down into Nova Scotia. But he never got over to PEI because it's an island. He'd be too confined there. So then he was eventually captured in Campbellton on his third visit to our beloved city. That was his third visit there.
Hmm. Now, when he first escaped, and you talked about the going down the railroad tracks, he ran into an officer named Carl Bordelon, and that video has become world famous. And the officer, Officer Bordelon, almost a sad figure. It's there's a lot of pathos to his story in that McNair story, right?
Yeah, I agree with that. When I saw that video for the first time, it was captured on a camcorder in Officer Bordelon's cruiser. The encounter happened on railway tracks, railroad in the States, and the two men stopped there and chatted for a while, maybe 10 minutes. Bordelon had got a report of a possible escape from the federal penitentiary. He was given the facts of what the escapee looked like, except the picture was the wrong one. It was an old photograph. It showed McNair with a beard, and it was a fax, so it was really poor quality. The information on the facts was incorrect. Information about scars he never had, things like that. So no way could you really determine that it was McNair. And he had no power, no legal authority to hold him there, even though McNair did not have any proper ID. You don't have to have an ID to jog in railroad tracks in the States. So that was the situation. So he let him go, thinking he was not the guy. Turns out he was the guy. Officer Bordelon had gone back to the prison to get a better picture, and sure enough, that was the guy he had encountered. They moved in on him, had him surrounded, and there's no way he could get out of there, except McNair had a way. He heard the search dogs coming. There were two or three search dogs, bloodhounds. He could hear them barking. So he went under a bush that had very thick thorns, and knowing the dogs would not penetrate that bush. But of course, they could see him. But in Louisiana, the soil is very soft. And you know how soft it is? You can put your hands and fingers right in the soil and dig it up by hand. You don't even need a shovel. It's very moist and soft. So he dug a hole quickly, buried himself in that hole totally, covered himself with dirt and leaves. And so that the dogs could not see him, but they could smell him. So the bloodhounds came up to the bush, could smell McNair under there, and were barking furiously. But the handlers of the dogs bent down and looked under and thought, no one's under here. He must have been in this area. And they pulled the dogs away, and they continued tracking an old scent. So when I went to Louisiana and spoke to the sheriff's department there, they wanted to know how McNair had escaped their dogs. And I said, well, he did this. And I explained to the officers what I just explained to you, that he dug a hole and he buried himself in there. And I said, do you want proof of that? He said, yes, we'd like that. And I said, I can tell you the name of one of your dogs. Hmm. It's called Rufus. The officer said, that's right. That's one of our dogs, Rufus. I said, well, Rufus did his job. The handler did not. Not to knock the handler. Mm. But mm. I went around to where the dogs were kept. They're kept, funny enough, at a jail, maybe 20 miles away. And I went to that jail. I asked to speak to the warden. The warden was busy. The deputy warden comes out, almost like in the movies. Guy comes out wearing sunglasses. You can't really see the guy, you know. And he says, how can I help you? And I said, well, I just need confirmation that one of your search dogs, you're a bloodhound. His name is Rufus. And I said, sir, I cannot confirm any names for the dogs. And I said, well, you know, I don't want to take pictures of the dog or interview the bitch. I just need confirmation. But the guy didn't loosen up, you know, whatever. We had a bit of a chuckle, but I wasn't able to get official confirmation from him. But the other officers at the sheriff's department did confirm Rufus was a dog that sniffed out McNair, but he didn't catch him. And neither did anyone else. McNair was also lucky. People make a lot of his smarts, but he was one lucky guy. Either I or perhaps he's got people on the other side are looking after him. I don't know. Because he jumped into a large pond in Louisiana. You never, ever, ever do that unless you're suicidal. Because every pond has a gator. And if you go in there and they get a hold of you, you're in dire straits. They'll kill you. McNair heard a helicopter hovering over, coming, approaching him, dove into the water to avoid being spotted by the helicopter, had to remain in there, and he's trying to get dirty at the same time. But lucky for him, the gator must have been at the other end of the pond and maybe was on a diet or something. I don't know. But he didn't touch him, so he got out. But that's pure luck.
You're listening to Down Home Corner. I'm Steve Bijou, and we are all connected, from Glenn Levitt to Ghana. On this episode, we're connecting with Campbellton's Byron Christopher, and we're talking about Richard Lee McNair, someone on America's Most Wanted, how he came to be captured by RCMP in Campbellton.
But eventually made his way to Canada, and his first visit to Campbellton, I recall, he was just passing through. His second visit, he pulled off that highway that runs in front of the Sugarloaf and Valdemore Drive or somewhere around there, and he pulled off into a motel, and I forget the name of it, but he parked in back, and McNair didn't go into the motel. He stayed in the van. He used the van as a camper. So he's in his van sleeping, and then he hears some kids tugging at the door handle. They wanted to get into his vehicle at about 3 in the morning. He didn't think there were thieves or just kids fooling around. Hmm. But McNair has always been super cautious. So at that point, he made his way to the cab of his van, fired up the engine, and then drove over the Charlie Van Horn Bridge down the Gaspé side. So he went over to the Quebec side. His third time was in Campbellton, was the time he was captured. And the day before, he had been spotted on the highway somewhere between Dalhousie and Campbellton, in that area, I forget the name of the community, spotted by an off-duty policeman. It wasn't McNair who was spotted, it was his van that looked a bit suspicious. The back windows were tinted over with a homemade tint job, yet the vehicle was fairly new, so it didn't quite add up. Crappy tint job. A new vehicle. Hmm. The officer thought the driver may have been smuggling cigarettes from the First Nations opposite Campbellton, or booze. So he copies down the number, phones it into his dispatch in Camelton, and they're all busy, so they couldn't intercept the vehicle. The next day, McNair wakes up. He spent the night parked in his van at the Super 8 Motel downtown. I think that's the name of it. It's very close to a grocery store there.
Yeah, right, Sobeys. Across. Yeah, and the landmark in town, the liquor store.
That's right. That's where I always go. I'm just kidding.
I know. You tell people, you say, do you know where the liquor store is? Well, you go left from here, and then you go right from here, and then you go straight from there. Anyway, back to your story. Sorry, Buck.
Yeah. So, and funny enough, McNair did not drink, nor did he smoke, nor did he do any dope, you know. But he parks his van at the western edge of the parking lot there under some big trees. There's like a senior's home there now. But that's where he parked his van. He always did that so he'd have some sort of shelter and he could sleep in the back of the van. And he pulled out his pie plate, an aluminum pie plate, to get better reception from the Super 8 Motel. And he could jump on the internet. He did that kind of thing. Get back to reading a novel he'd been going through. And in the morning, he woke up and went down to the Tim Hortons in the city center where he grabbed a bite to eat. And then he had made his way to the library. The old library, as it was then, up just off Andrew Street near the Baptist Church. So he goes there and it's closed, not opening until 10. It's back in his van, makes his way. He's now going southbound on Andrew. And when he gets down to Andrew and Water Street, he sees lights flashing behind him. It's an RCMP cruiser with two officers in it. They want him to pull over. So he wondered, what's going on here? I've been signaling. What's the deal? So then he veers to his right into a parking area, a parking lot, which is part of a complex. It's right beside a drugstore. I forget the name of it. Jean Coutu?
Jean Coutu, yes.
Yeah, did I say that right?
You did.
Said it with that French accent?
Yeah. Well, ask the people from down home. That's up to them.
Yeah, sorry. That's about it for my French vocabulary. The only other word I know in French is Chevrolet.
Well, you're doing okay.
So he goes through the parking lot. The cops, meanwhile, are wondering, why isn't he stopping? You know, we just want to check. He's got contraband cigarettes and alcohol. But McNair tries to make a run for it. There's a bit of a pathway that leads back onto Andrew Street, but it's blocked by some large rocks. So McNair slowly creeps up with his van to this big boulder and nudges it aside, you know. It's what you would call a typical Canadian high-speed chase to even stop as the other guy nudges the rocks aside. And then he makes his way back onto Andrew, and here he is driving a big van, and the cops, of course, have their souped-up cruiser. So it's not really, much of a chase. And they've got the lights on, and, you know. And it's kind of neat because Camelton is this little sleepy town, and all the dozens of people I talked to, no one remembers that chase. I don't know why, because it was so uneventful.
You know why?
Oh, well, here's a police chase. They're going at least 20 Ks here. This is an exciting one.
And they stop to let people out in traffic. That's what you do back home, right?
Yeah, right. They may stop to pick up some litter or something, you know, whatever.
It's a great cover-up. Just blend in.
Right. So he makes his way southbound on Andrew to the top of the hill where there's a high school nearby. And of course, being in a school zone, everybody slows down, even the man being pursued and the police. It's all very polite. And they whip down this very steep hill, get down to the bottom. McNair is meanwhile on his GPS unit, trying to find a way out of town. Actually, the cops say he's trying to find his way back to the highway. Not that that would matter. He's not going to get anywhere in the van. But he ends up going under that little overpass there, right up to the psychiatric unit, which is a dead-end street. And he drives back and forth there, and the cops are watching him sitting, saying, what's wrong with this guy? You know, he's not getting out of here. So McNair decides to bolt it across the lawn. He has his car in a ditch, and he shoots it right up in that little ring road there, and then ends up going in a parking area where you park your vehicle if you want to walk on the Terry Fox Trail. Mm-hmm. So there's no vehicle there at all where he can hide behind. So he continues driving down the little pathway that would lead to the trail. And he comes across a gateway that prohibits vehicles from going on that path. So in a panic, he turns to the left. He should have turned to the right because there was a cut line through the woods. He could have hidden the van down there for a few minutes anyway. But anyway, he makes this mistake. He turns to the left, bangs into a big rock. He's not getting anywhere. He's pulled up so close to a tree that he can't get out of the driver's side. He's got to weasel his way over on the passenger side, grab a few things and make a run for it. And by this, at this point, the officers had spotted his van sticking out and saw him getting out and making a break for it in the woods. And they eventually tackled him in woods. When they brought him down, the officers, of course, spoke French. McNair spoke only English. And he tried to tell them that he was an escaped murderer from a federal penitentiary in Pollock, Louisiana. And he was one of America's most wanted. And one of the officers says, "We don't watch that TV show here. We're Canadians." Of course, a different meaning. Whatever. So they handcuffed this guy, and they put him in the back of the cruiser, and he's sitting there in the back seat, and officers in the front, and they're going through his wallet. They pulled out his driving license. It's a fake license that McNair did, but it's he did it so well, the officer thought the Alaska driving license was real. It's under the fake name of Troy Snyder. So he turns around and says to McNair, "You're not Richard Lee McNair. You're Troy Snyder. Look." And McNair says, "No, I'm Richard Lee McNair. That's fake. I made that. Give it to me and I can peel it. I can take it apart for you, you know." So there's a bit of an argument. So here we go. We think back 18 months earlier, McNair, fugitive McNair, is on railroad tracks in Louisiana trying to convince an officer that he's some jogger named Robert Jones and so forth. And now he's in Canada. The police apprehend him. Now the reverse is true. He's trying to convince him he's Richard Lee McNair. And in any case, they don't believe him.
Bizarre.
And they ended up phoning the U.S. Marshals in Louisiana and Marshal Bellegarde. And as soon as Bellegarde heard him talk in the background, he knew it was McNair. He said, "We'll fingerprint him and then we'll confirm it. But that sounds like McNair. I've heard a lot of phone conversations with him." So, and that's how they got him. But when they put him in a cell in Campbellton, number 3, if you're ever in the holding cells there, McNair was in number 3. And he spent a lot of time meditating, like in a lotus position. And the officers would pull back the little peephole and check on him. There he'd be on the floor meditating. So I wrote to McNair, and I've actually got a lot of letters from him, maybe 340 now. And I said, "Were you on the floor in a lotus position? What the hell's that about?" I said, "Yes, he was. I said, "Were you meditating?" He said, "No, I was trying to get the mothership to beam me out of there."
You're listening to Down Home Corner. I'm your host, Down Homer, Steve Bijou. Our guest, journalist and reporter Byron Christopher. Byron isn't the only famous broadcaster from Campbellton, you know.
Hi, I'm Peter Marr, retired play-by-play broadcaster for the Calgary Flames and a native of Campbellton. I remember Byron Christopher first from our time in Campbellton when Byron went to Campbellton High School, played indoor soccer for Donnie Hume's Speed Demons. Later, he followed in the same path I had the good fortune of doing, working in broadcasting at CKNB while attending Campbellton High. Early on in my NHL play-by-play broadcast career, I reconnected with Byron at a number of times in Edmonton when he worked with CBC Radio and later Ched Radio. Mostly, we'd meet and chat after and prior to Flame Oiler games. Byron was and is a hardworking, dedicated reporter, very thorough in his research, reporting, and interviewing. Byron has revealed a number of headline-grabbing investigative journalism stories, or scoops, as they were referred to in the old days. From the beginning, it was very evident Byron had the dedication, discipline, and talent to attain the outstanding career success he's achieved.
Now back to our story about Richard Lee McNair and his crazy capture in Campbellton.
How long was he in Campbellton? How long did they keep him in custody in Campbellton before they shipped him away?
I think just a day and a half or so, maybe 2 days at the most. But they wanted him out of there and sent to the penitentiary in Miramichi. And they would hold him there for a few more days and then ship him across the border in a cruiser. And that's what happened. But he wasn't there very long. I think he was there for a day and a half, if that. Yeah. And he's very praising of the officers in Campbellton. He thought they're quite professional. In fact, the commanding officer, whose name I've forgotten now, went in McNair's cell to chat with him. And McNair told him, he said, your men are well behaved. They're very professional. So the officer said, well, I take that as a compliment. And indeed, it was true. So when I went back to Camelton researching for the book, I went around to the RCMP detachment. In fact, it was about 1 in the morning, believe it or not, because I'd been to the top of the Sugarloaf taking nighttime time-lapse shots. So I arrived there and I was pretty tired. But one of the officers involved in the capture, there were three, one of them was on duty. So we had a great chat. And he brought me out to the warehouse where McNair's bike was, his bicycle. They held that in there and a lot of his possessions. I went through them. In fact, the officer said his bike is up there. And I said, can I take it down? He said, yeah, let me give you a hand. We took your bike down. He said, sit on it. Let me get your camera. And let me get a picture of you on Richard's bike. And you send it to him. That'll get him going. <You know? laughs> So they had fairly good rapport with this guy. They wanted to know how McNair was doing and what he was up to and so forth. And they're sort of respectful of him. Because when, after he was captured, they realized he hadn't committed any violence. Crimes. He hadn't attacked anyone, or murdered anyone, or even assaulted anyone.
Yeah.
He did a lot of property crimes, but he did no crimes of violence. That's why he was never charged.
He had looked at stealing vehicles in Campbellton, too,
yes.
Didn't he?
Yep, I think that was the second trip. He looked at a break-in at and I'm not sure of the location. There's a Tim Hortons nearby. And there used to be a Harvey's restaurant there, and it became a car dealership, and I'm not sure of the car dealership.
It could be Kia. I could be Kia. Yep. I could be wrong, but it could be Kia.
Yep, I believe it is Kia. But in any case, McNair was walking around. It was closed. It was an evening, and he walked around the dealership and pushed on a door that was on the east side. It's a man door, and the door opened.
Oh.
He went, whoa, this is ideal. But he didn't go in. He walked to his van and drove the van to a parking lot of that shopping center down there. There used to be a Sears down there, and, you know, it's a large shopping center. So he's in the parking lot there keeping his eye on that dealership. For 2 hours, he watched it. So then he got up to the dealership, walked up there, and as he walked up, some car pulled up. It was the sales manager. So that was the end of the break-in. So the guy, McNair, told this man, by the way, your side door is open over here. He said, oh, okay, thanks for that. And then he left. So who was that fellow? And I've forgotten his name. It's a French guy. And I talked with him. He said he remembered that. They called him the Good Samaritan. But he had no idea that it was Richard Lee McNair.
It's bizarre.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in a lot of these cases, I mean, if you take the two who escaped from New York State, for instance, these were dangerous criminals that people were fearing for their lives. And I'm not trying to minimize McNair or what he did, but he was almost a criminal with morals.
Yeah, somewhat. He was not violent. He never had any weapons on him. And not only that, he was into healthy living. You know, he would never drink pop. He'd pour that out and drink water. And he would never have any alcohol nor drugs. And he wouldn't smoke. Anything like that. It seemed odd because a lot of prisoners are into more of that lifestyle. Mm. But there's another break-in he tried to do. It was in Ethelville, just west of Camelton. He drove out there and there was a car dealership there. And I think it was Chrysler, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think
but
you're talking
I can
about
tell you it was right...
Central Garage is what you're referring to, I believe.
Yep, okay.
Yeah, next to Dairy Queen.
He remembers the Dairy Queen.
Okay.
So he walks to the back of that. It's dark, about 10 o'clock at night, and there are windows in the bay doors at the back where they do maintenance work in the vehicles. McNair peeks in. Who's in there? Some guy working on a car. So that ended that thought of a break-in there. He couldn't do it with the worker in there. But he had looked at taking a vehicle from that Chrysler dealership there. So it was a no-go, and he ended up moving out of town. But, yeah, those are his visits to Camelton. So when I was back there, just about a year after McNair was captured, I had a couple of beer with one of the reporters at the Camelton Tribune newspaper, Trevor McNally. He wanted to talk about journalism, so we met at a pub downtown on Roseberry Street, right next to Tim Hortons, and it may have been called Dooley's then. I don't know.
Yes, for sure. Bob Putra. Yeah. Okay. You remember him from CKNB? Well, he's the man who owns Dooley's. That is Dooley's.
Okay. Yeah. No, so the name hasn't changed. How about that? It's a record for Camelton. It's been there for 10 years.
Oh, Bob runs a good business.
So it was in there where Trevor and I were talking about journalism. So I said to him, what kind of stories do you cover? And he gave me a range. And I said, well, it's not like Edmonton where you've got like a murder a week, you know, easy here and on slow years, you know. But Campbellton is a much smaller community and it's not as much to cover in terms of hard news. But he said one big story was the capture of Richard Lee McNair. And I said, who's that? And he said, oh, you know, that American killer. They captured. I said, oh, yeah, that was in all the news. And I said, well, why don't you write him? And Trevor said, well, he would never write back. And I said, well, you don't know until you try. But I don't think he's been interviewed. He's been captured for about a year, and I haven't seen any quote from him. He should be in a maximum security federal penitentiary. And I showed him how to find out where he was, you know. So, okay. So Trevor ends up writing him a letter. And either the letter never got to the guards, it was destroyed or something, I don't know. It was just simply a list of questions. So I mentioned to Trevor, if he doesn't write back, I will write him and I will ask him some questions. And McNair wrote back, and it was his first communication with any reporter. And I was quite excited at that. I phoned the Journal, the Camelton Tribune, talked to the editor, Tim Jakes, and said, I've got word back from Richard Lee McNair. And they ended up doing a story on it. So, and then one thing led to the other. And I was back in town about a year later. And at this point, I'd collected maybe 30, 40 letters in there. And I was back in Camelton and met with the publisher, Billingham. I think his first name was David. I'm not positive now. But he was the running show then. And he said, you know, it'd be nice if you could do a series for us on McNair. You have all these letters. And I showed him some of the envelopes. And he was going through McNair's letters and showed illustrations and diagrams of where he had been and maps and everything else. And he said, this is fascinating. Would you do a series for us? And I said, well, I could think about that. So we agreed on a price. And I said, how many episodes would you like? Would it be 3? He said, I think maybe closer to 5. Turned out to be 6. Yeah. So we ended up doing that. And it got the Camelton Tribune a national newspaper award. It was a huge thing for them. It also got them an award for the best in Atlantic Canada. So the series went over well.
Yeah, it was called The Running. I phoned
the judge. The judge was in, it's called The Running Man. Mm. That title came from someone at the Tribune. I've forgotten who it was now. It wasn't my title. But I recall phoning the judge who selected that. She was in Halifax, I believe. I'm not positive now. Thanking her for her good taste. And she said it was an easy choice. She said, we looked at all the contributions across Canada, and that went way out in front. So that was good for them, good for me, and good for the Tribune.
Well, it was the first national award for the Tribune as well. So, you know, kind of a good down-home thing you did, too.
Yeah, it made me feel good. You know, I'm from Camelton, and I had written articles for the Tribune when I was a young guy going to high school. They were sports stories, so pretty well. So it was different to do a feature story than that, and to see it get a national award was good for the Tribune. Yeah, I have the award here behind me, the plaque. It was presented at the Four Seasons Hotel in Toronto the following year, so that's pretty cool. And that's the story of McNair and the Camelton Tribune and Camelton, period.
I said it's 9 below 0, and the snow ain't even on the ground. Sure, it's 9 below 0, baby, and the snow ain't even on the ground. You know snow is 9 below zero. And my baby left town. I said it's late in the evening, and there ain't nobody else around. You know it's late in the evening, honey, and there ain't nobody else around. You know it's 9 below zero. Yo, my baby left town. Let me hear something, son.
Still is the Prime Minister of the Blues, Dutch Mason. 9 Below Zero. Did you ever catch Dutchie live in a bar somewhere in the East Coast? Oh man, he was something else. And now back to our show with Byron Christopher.
Well, Byron, that's of course an interesting story about Richard Lee McNair. Adds a bit more color to our already colorful town, I guess. But a couple of the stories that you talk about on your blog, ByronChristopher.org, are two people who kind of make up some of the fabric of our home region.
people who are kind of intertwined, and everybody kind of knows characters and hometown heroes, so to speak. One person that virtually everybody from Campbellton would know would be Bobby Steeves. And you have a story about Bobby on there. And with Bobby, I guess everybody would have a story that would know Bobby over the years. But for you, yours was a story that kind of haunted you since you were a kid, and you wanted to make good on that.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And for those who don't know Bobby Steeves, he's gay. And he has another challenge, if I can put it that way. He's mentally handicapped. So he was targeted with a lot of violence when he was young. And I suspect even as a younger man, maybe not so much now, but back then in the 50s and the 60s, he was given terrible beatings in the town. And no one really thought anything of it. He was different. So people beat him up. You know, I think that kind of stuff happened all over the place. Certainly did in my hometown. And I remember clearly walking to the old Rosebery Street School. I would have been in grade one, maybe two, but grade one for sure. And walking down the street with my friends, group of half a dozen of us or so, and there was this commotion off to the side. And a boy, a bit older than us, was being chased by a bully. And the boy fell. He hit the ground. And the bully was on top of him right away. He was pinned up against a picket fence. He couldn't escape. And he got one pounding. The guy just punched him and punched him and kicked him and kicked him. And no matter how much that kid on the ground pleaded, I remember him turtling to try to protect his head from the blows. Nothing stopped the guy. And the guy just stopped punching when he was exhausted. So I stood there, maybe 20 feet away, I don't know, but I did nothing. I didn't speak out. You know, I suspect he may have pounded me out too, and that was part of the reason I was quiet. But still, you know, it doesn't leave you with a good feeling. You go to school and you think about that. I thought about it forever. I'll never forget what I saw that day. And then as I grew older, of course, I left Campbellton when I was 18, but when I returned, sometimes I would see Bobby Steeves. He'd be walking on the street somewhere, and a car would drive by, and someone would toot, and they'd say, "Hi, Bobby," and he'd turn around and wave, and he'd smile, and they'd smile, and they were teasing him. They were having fun at his expense, although I'm not too sure if he knew that, because he was simple. Nonetheless, I saw it. I didn't say anything, didn't even object to anyone, but it bothered me, you know, that I was silent. I knew that it was abuse, it was a form of hatred. And as I grew even older, I thought, well, why don't I do something about that? Why don't I do a story on it? And I suggested it to a reporter in Campbellton. He went, no, we don't want to do that. It would just make things worse for him. And last year, I was in Campbellton, and I asked where Bobby Steeves lived. People told me where he lived. I went around and knocked on the door. I didn't hear anything happening. So I left, and I returned and knocked on the door, and the voice said, come on in. So I walked down into this basement apartment. I walked down the stairs, and there he was, standing there, looking puzzled. I told him who I was. I gave him my business card, and he was studying it. He didn't place me, of course. I said, I remember something that happened to you that was bad. It was an attack by this man. I'll give him the name of Bobun. He knew him, remembered that attack, and gave me his real name. I said, yeah, that's the guy. I said, well, Bobby, I saw that attack, but I did nothing, and I'm sorry about that. He said nothing. Other than that's okay, you know. And I said, I'd like to do a story on you. And he said, well, where would it go? And I said, well, it would go on my blog. Do you have the internet? He said, no, I don't have it. I said, well, it'll be out there for Campbellton to see, in fact, for the world to see. Well, okay. Do you want to do it now? And I said, no, not now. I just wanted to shake hands to let you know who I was. And that I told him that I would be back, that I was on my way to Montreal, then Ottawa, and would return to Montreal and then Campbellton, and then we would do it. So I returned, phoned him, and went over and picked him up, brought him to a graveyard in Camelton where his mother was buried. And he's really attached to his mother. That's why I chose that. So we talked about that. We were there for maybe 20 minutes or so, and then I brought him to a restaurant called the Sandfar in Tidehead. We had a nice breakfast there, and that's where I did the interview, or more of it. And then when I returned to Edmonton, I put everything together and looked at the photos and wrote up the story. And the story took off. My goodness. Hmm. It had, like, as of today, it's closing in on 13,000 views, and that's a lot, you know,
wow,
for a blog that's not connected to a major media outfit. So it's drawn quite a response from the community. A lot of people wrote in to say they were affected by it. Some guys shared that they were gay too, and they had suffered through similar abuse, although not as badly as what Bobby Steeves did. But really, this story, from my perspective, was that I was trying to say I'm sorry, you know, for being such a weak person.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm not like that ever again. And I hope that the word here is turned my life around. I hope that I'm not that person anymore. That I used to turn away to that, but not anymore. Mm. So that's me trying to come clean. And I felt that, you know, the readers, they could relate to that because there were a lot of Byrons in the town.
Mm.
People that saw it, they didn't take part in the violence, but they didn't do anything either.
You know?
They were like, they were the silent majority.
And through a number of generations,
that's
too, you know, and through a number of generations, not just one age group, you know, that I mean, because he's been around there since virtually birth, and everybody knew him, you know, so when he was young and then when he was older, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that story goes, it reaches generations.
Yeah, and to me, what was touching about it, when we sat down at that restaurant for the interview, and I pulled up my notepad and the pen, and I was making note of what he was talking about. And I was asking questions. He was answering them. He came clean on the questions. And I said, well, I'd like to talk about something that's unpleasant now. All those attacks you had, and I witnessed one, and I saw the abuse in others, and there would have been hundreds of them. I'm giving you a platform now, a forum, to say what you want to say about these goons and bullies. What do you have to tell them? And he looked at me and didn't say anything for maybe 5 seconds. And he said, there are some nice people here. There's some very nice people. I went, whoa. I was expecting a tirade of, you know, I wish I had a gun or a grenade or something, you know.
Yeah.
But no, he showed love and compassion, and that really threw me.
Yeah, lesson for all of us, maybe.
It made me feel ashamed again, you know, somehow. And so I wrote about that, how I felt about it, and that's the way it is.
Wow.
The story has taken off. I'm glad to see that. And for some people in Camelton, and perhaps it's a redemption for them as well. I don't know.
Mm.
But it certainly got out there.
Well, his response would probably let a few people who felt guilty about past efforts and past deeds off the hook a bit, too.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I just didn't expect that response.
Kinda.
I set it up, you know, I walked him through the attack as I saw it by Bobun and the abuse by others. So, and I set the stage. I said, well, now it's your chance to speak out, you know.
Oh.
Now, most people would have lashed out at that, but he didn't. He just showed compassion and love.
And a childlike person shall lead them. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the Bobby Steeves story.
Yeah, pretty heroic in some ways when you think of it, when you think of his response, and that kind of leads us to somebody else. Don Hume is somebody that a lot of other people from our hometown would know. For me, I know Don going back to when I was a teenager in radio, and even before that, listening to him on the radio. He was a familiar voice for me, so maybe a bit of a seed in there as well.
Yeah,
but
right.
The reason I think Don Hume is a hometown hero is he's all about good values, and he's about giving, not taking. And I think he's always had the amazing knack for getting people to buy into a good cause or a helping cause, you know? He got people on board really easy. And I think one thing that's far-reaching, that influenced a lot of young minds back home and continued to go on and serve that cause, I guess, was a little soccer team called the Speed Demons.
Yeah, that's right. Don Hume, you're correct. He was a disc jockey and announcer. He read news as well. And I see there are write-ups about him. He was quite popular. He's very popular. I know the St. John Telegraph Journal newspaper did quite a story on him at the height of his heyday there. So he was very well known in not only Campbellton, but the community. He had a great voice. He still does. He's quite an accomplished broadcaster.
Yeah.
I've often wondered if Don was in a major market like Toronto or Vancouver, how far he could have gone. But he chose to stay in Campbellton. I guess he didn't want to leave the town. And that's where he, you know, that's where he still is to this day. But you're right. He's a very giving person. He's one of these Christians who actually walks the talk.
Mm.
You know, he's a guy that if Jesus came back, Jesus would hang out with him. You know? he's a cool guy.
He is.
I mean, he's not pure, and nobody is. You know, I've met Mother Teresa, but I consider it more my perspective. I get a bigger kick out of meeting Don Hume. You know,
he's a pretty humble guy. He was always so humble, no matter what. Like you can, not easy to give Don a compliment because he's just so humble.
No.
You know, but
the accolades just fly right by him, and you say, "What are you talking about?"
Yeah. I remember asking him. I said, "What he?" Because he was Peter Marr's. I mean, you want to talk historical? He was Peter Marr's first color commentator. He's the first person that Peter would have worked with when he did play-by-play. And I said, what do you think you taught Peter over, you know, that he would have taken with him over the years? Oh, nothing. Absolutely nothing. Oh, come on, Donnie, tell me. No, nothing. And I couldn't get him to say anything. I tried repeatedly, and he just wasn't going to go there. It's just the type of guy he is. But the Speed Demons was a soccer team that was put together as a high school league or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, you're close on that. It was part of a church league.
Right.
There were several churches. Each had their soccer teams. And it was indoor soccer, which at the time, we're talking here 60s and 70s, was a novelty.
Mm.
All soccer back then was played outdoors, except this was played indoors, much along the lines of ice hockey, where you had a goaltender, two defensemen, and three forwards was played. And there was checking was allowed. which I didn't agree with, but nonetheless, you had boards and you get hit pretty hard. And, you know, kids can play with their hearts, teenagers.
Yeah, soccer by hockey rules, I guess, eh?
Yeah, it's actually, and even the nets were smaller, so the scoring was not high, you know. But the games were, they were great games, you know. We had a pretty good team. Our team was called the Speed Demons. Strange name for a team affiliated with a church. But the boys had chosen the name, and Don said, no, they chose it, and that's the name we're going with. And we were based out of the Baptist church. And you didn't have to be a Baptist to belong to the team. I mean, I wasn't connected with any religion, and that was fine with them. I played defense. My partner was Mike Trites, who's retired now and living in Fredericton. Yeah, we had quite a good club, and during the summer months when we were not playing soccer, we went on these tours or trips around the Maritime provinces. And for the kids whose parents didn't have cars, that was quite an exciting time. You know, we all piled into the vehicles, three or four vehicles, and made our way east down towards Dalhousie and Bathurst and then past Newcastle, all names previous to us, just on the map, you know. And then in places like Moncton and Fredericton. And then we crossed the border into Nova Scotia. And that was exciting. There were pictures taken there. It's a big thing, you know, for
you. Oh, yeah.
And to be in Halifax and Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, and then over to PEI. And these are great little trips.
So you would have learned about other cultures and other towns. And that was great because it was all about inclusiveness. You know, you even learned religious tolerance and things like that.
Yeah, we went to different churches as well. Some of the boys on the team were Catholic, and so we attended their churches out of respect, or Pentecostal, you know. And there were natives on the team from the reserve across the river. So it was quite a team. There was a junior team that was came out, I think, in the mid-60s as well, just younger kids. And then there was a junior league set up. So you sort of graduated from the juniors up into the major team. And when you graduated from high school, that was it. Couldn't play anymore. So that's when I left, when I was 18. Yeah. And, yeah, those were great moments. But you learned a lot, you know, like even at our team meetings. Things were voted on. So you learned about democracy and you learned how to be grateful. There were businesses in Camelton that donated goods to us or donated money. And for that, we used to buy equipment and we would sign a thank you card. Have all the guys sign it and give it to the business person. Well, you know, every time that I sign a thank you card for someone, I am brought back to the basement of that Baptist Church, right there.
Isn't that
right
wonderful?
There again.
Wow.
Yeah, and you see that these are lessons that you learn early on, and you know they say you can take the boy from the country, but you can't take the memories from the boy.
Hmm.
And I see that happening with myself and the Speed Demons and Don Hume, and you know he walked the talk. Once you'd left the team, and you went around to his door and rang the doorbell, he invited you in. He knew who you were, the number you wore, and everything. You know, even though there were quite a few guys that have played for the team over time, he kept in touch with probably all of them, you know, humanly possible. He did that, and the strange thing is that Don had no children himself, and yet in a sense he did. He had 77. You know, there's almost like a pilgrimage every summer. Someone's ringing the doorbell, and there's a player from the team. Hey, how are you doing? Thought I'd drop by and see how you're making out. And you can tease Don, too, you know. He's put on a bit of weight. And the last time I saw him, I said, Don, if we have another reunion and another game, you're going in net. No one's scoring on you. And he'll say, hey, that's not right. But he'll chuckle away, you know.
Yeah.
He said, let's get out and get a bite to eat. And off we go. You know, and he's concerned if any of the players or former players now, pardon me, are having difficulty, maybe a marriage problem or a financial problem, it wears on him. And so he's loyal, very, very loyal. So when I did this story on Don Hume on the blog, it was meant as a tribute to him. Well, he complained about it. He said, well, why would you do that? And I said, well, you know, I was drunk one day and I wrote it. So there you go. You know, have a little fun with the guy. But he wanted the Speed Demons included. Can you put in some photographs of the players? I said, yeah, I can do that. And now it's kind of evolved into that now. Now it's sort of a Speed Demon thing, which is okay with me. But that's gone, you know, deflect the accolades and that. So,
yeah. That's very good. I mean, I think a lot of the players wouldn't remember statistics and things of the league so much, but they'll always remember all those lessons they learned. And it was such a great blueprint. You know, good sportsmanship is a good blueprint for society. You know, that's why I've always been very supportive of minor sports and those kind of things, because in the right teams with the right people, it really shapes the young minds in the right way. I mean, you learn teamwork and you learn value and you learn giving and you learn sacrifice and all these things. And it sounds like that little league, that soccer league, you know, for as long as it lasted, the Speed Demons was a pretty cool thing, and its influence lives on and probably always will.
You sum it up quite well. Don Hume was inducted into Camelton Sports Hall of Fame as a builder. The team had a winning record over time. Toward the end, it wasn't winning as much, but you know nothing goes on forever.
Mm.
And so Don Hume was inducted into that Sports Hall of Fame. And there's a lot of good people in there. You just mentioned one earlier, Peter Marr. He's in there as well. So that's a cool thing for Don. You know, for a guy who was not active in sports, even when he was younger and he was in pretty good shape, he still was not a coordinated player. I remember he would play occasionally in a practice and a skirmish, and you could get around him fairly quickly. You know, some guys are coordinated for sports. Don wasn't, but he was more coordinated for fairness and techniques and strategy, line changes, things like that. But you mentioned about what it's like to be young and having those impressions made when you're younger. Well, you know, you've also
spoken with Glenn Hall, the former goaltender who played mm-hmm. in the National Hockey League for a few teams.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
Glenn and I were talking about his time in Saskatchewan when he was, you know, a teenager playing. And he was a forward, and then he ended up being a goaltender. But he remembers the very cold winters playing outside when it's like 30 below or something, and you're cold, and you know, you're walking home, and you can see all those stars in the sky. That's what he remembered. Isn't that funny that he would talk about that? And I said, Glenn, let me show you something. This is an old black and white picture of us playing road hockey in Campbellton in a place called the Swamp, just west of the city, actually in Atholville. We carved a place carved a rink out of nowhere. It had huge banks on it, like snow banks, or like 12 feet high. And he saw that. He said, wow, is that ever neat? You played hockey there? And I said, yeah, we did. And I said, never mind this stuff with you guys out of the prairies playing with frozen horse turds. You know, we had a tennis ball, and look at our sides, you know, the benches and the you know, the shoulders of the rink and that were up pretty high. Well, he got the greatest kick out of that. But then again, you know, you get two old guys talking about old memories, and they all go back to the kids.
Oh yeah,
you're
kids.
Very right about yeah. They all go back
hockey.
To the childhood. Yeah,
just
getting back to Don Hume, it's the same kind of thing. You know, when last year I went to one of the halls that we had played in, it was in Dalhousie. It's now a church. It's the older church had burned down. They now use the gymnasium as a church. So I walked in there, and it all kind of came back. You know, it was just me, and I had a lady with me, but it was just me and my memories there, really, you know. You know, I remember the deflections off the wall and the boards and trying to protect the goaltender and how to get it up. And, yeah, I remember the windows being up there, and yeah, it was kind of neat. A lot of memories come back.
I got a chance to walk through Restigouche Senior High School a few years back, and it was the same for me. It had been, I don't know, 25 years since I'd been in that building, and it just floods all the memories coming back. Well, Byron, thanks a lot for those stories and other stories, and some of them you can read on your blog, byronchristopher.org. Thanks for sharing the story of Richard Lee McNair. I mean, not only his story of how he was captured in Campbellton, but the whole timeline. It's a very interesting story, and it just adds more color to our town, like I was saying. And also, thanks for being a character and a bit of a hometown hero yourself, Byron. You bring a lot of spotlight and a lot of attention to our little region back home, and you're a true down homer. Thanks for being on the program, Byron.
Well, thank you, and all the best.
Sonny lives on a farm, on a wide open space. You could take off your shoes, give up the race. You could lay down your head by a sweet riverbed. But Sonny always remembers what it was his mama said. Oh, Sonny, don't. I am here all alone. Your daddy's a sailor who never comes home. All these nights get so long, and the silence goes on, and I'm feeling so tired, not all that strong. Sonny carries a load, though he's barely a man. There ain't all that to do, still he does what he can. And he watches the sea from a room by the stairs, and the waves keep on rolling. They've done that for years and years. Oh, Sonny, don't go away. I am here all alone. Your daddy's a sailor . These nights get so long, the silence goes on, and I'm feeling so tired, not all that strong. Sonny's
Son, his dreams can't be real. They're just stories he's read. They're just stars in his eyes. They're just dreams in his head. And he's hungry inside for the wide world outside. And I know I can't hold him, though I tried and I tried and I tried. Oh, son, it don't go away. I am here all alone. Your daddy's a sailor who never comes home. All these nights get so long. The silence goes on and I'm feeling so tired, not all that strong. Oh, son, it don't go away, I am here all alone. Your daddy's a sailor who never comes home. All these nights get so long. The silence goes on and I'm feeling so tired, not all that strong.
That was Ron Hines and Sonny's Dream. And that's our show. Down Home Corner is produced by Mike Sacchetta and me, Steve Bijou. Thanks to our guest, Byron Christopher, or if you're listening in Australia, Chris Byron. Thanks to Peter Maher for his cameo appearance. Peter, we miss you on the air. Get that book done, will ya? Please remember to share this episode on Facebook, and we'll connect with even more Down Homers. Please put a like on our Facebook page if you haven't already. It all helps. Thanks again for your support. Coming up on future episodes of Down Home Corner, Ed Saunders from the Saunders Brothers Show, East Coast Kitchen Parties, great original band from Nova Scotia. Also, John Paris Jr. will join us. He's from Windsor, Nova Scotia, arguably the birthplace of hockey. John was the first black coach in professional hockey. He won the Turner Cup, the Air Canada Cup, and he also coached the Restigouche Tigers. We'll talk with John about his career, the Hall of Fame players he competed with and against, the NHL today, and we'll talk about John Paris's book, They Called Me Chocolate Rocket. Great book. So please, watch for our next edition of Steve Bijou's Down Home Corner, and watch for our website, downhomecorner.com. I'm Steve Bijou, a Down Homer, and if you're a Down Homer, remember, we are all connected.